Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 304. I hope you're all well. I am well. I was really looking forward to this conversation. As we mentioned, I think, in the episode, me and Neve, are we proper buddied up after she came on 2019, maybe? Or maybe beginning of 2020. Might have been beginning of 2020, you know, because it was just before Calm with Horses came out, which means it was just before the pandemic, because that dropped like the week the pandemic all started. But yeah, we'd both been chatting a bit whilst filming on different projects, and we got on some interesting subjects about like mental health on and off set and stuff like that. And I was gonna have her on to discuss it on the May Where's Your Head At mental health specials. But then we decided we had far more we wanted to talk about. She's got a new film out called Censor, which is amazing and is in cinemas now. And I highly recommend you go and see it. It's about a woman in the late 80s working on the board of censorship for her films in the era of video nasty. So she's having to view all of these things. And yeah, it's wonderful. It's a horror. It's a thriller. It's, yeah, I think you're going to enjoy it a lot. Or a lot of you will have heard Prano Belly Bond on recently talking about it, of course. So yeah, go and check that out in the cinemas. But she's also got a series out called Deceit. And that blew me away as well. So much so that next week I've got a Nathaniel Martello White on, who was also in The Deceit. It's on Channel 4. It'll be on the 4-player options, all that kind of goodness. Yeah. And I highly recommend it. So basically, we figured that there was more that we wanted to talk about than just a little 10-minute segment on the mental health episode. So yeah, that's why we lined up this full chat. And I hope you enjoy it, because I enjoyed it. We recorded this while Neve was in her quarantine after travelling back from filming Raised by Wolves with Ridley Scott, of all people. So obviously there's a lot to talk about. This has all happened in the periods since Neve was last on the podcast. So yeah, man, loads to talk about. And she's just been confirmed in a film with other favourite and previous guests, Florence Pugh. So I can't wait to see the two of them on a project together. All very exciting. Let's stop rambling on. As ever, head over to speechdevelopmentrecords.com to support the podcast. We've got merch over there. There's loads of good merch for whatever weather Britain chooses to throw at us in these strange times. And we've also now got the 10-year anniversary white vinyl of Distraction Pieces, my debut solo album. And I went out into the woods in Vancouver and recorded a spoken word version of it. I went out there on my own and found a good spot, set up my equipment and recorded a spoken word version of the album. That's all available at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. As said, if this is your first time tuning in, go and check out the Prano Bailey Bond one. Or if you just missed that, go and check that out. That was a couple of weeks back. Other people that Neve has worked with, Stephen Graham. He's been on 3 times now, I think. He's a regular, that boy. But yeah, loads of really good episodes to check out. Another person who's in Deceit, Eddie Marson, previous guest. I can't think of any more off the top of my head now. Michael Smiley is in Censor. So yeah, loads of good previous guests if you want to check them out. And the aforementioned Florence Pugh. So yeah, let's get on with the podcast. This is episode 404 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the return of Neve Algar. I'm rolling. Right, I'm here today with Neve Algar. How are you?
I'm good, Pip. I'm good. We're coming to you live outside Buckingham Palace.
Yes, you're on, is it day 3 or day 4 of quarantine?
What is it? I have 6 more sleeps. That's how I've worked it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's intense.
Actually, do you know what? It hasn't been just yet.
Yeah.
Because we've been like, I just came off of Raised by Wolves, and everyone's doing the quarantine. So what the production have done is they've set up online exercises for ourselves and
amazing
therapy. They've given us like access to counselling and meditation.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
That's so good. I was going to kind of ask about that because I know Raised by Wolves, it is a physical one. And I know, you know, I've seen that there has been regular exercise regime and all this kind of thing. So things like that often get overlooked when you go from a regular workout regime to a 10-day quarantine where, and you're in the quarantine hotel because you've come from a red list country. So you're literally, you can't leave a room. And I believe fitness stuff is everyone's individual choice, but I do believe it can be really good for your mental health. So if you're going into a weird situation to suddenly have the drop off of endorphins or whatever from what you were doing and from being on set, you know, it looks like a really fun set. So from being on set every day to being in a room on your own, that must be weird. So that's awesome that they've put all that together.
Yeah, they're really clued in with it, you know. And even when we were, you know, doing the shoot, it was the first time this season that we had an intimacy coordinator. She was also qualified with, it's like emotional let go. So if you're doing scenes that are quite emotionally heavy, you know, she basically just at the end of the scene will just kind of reset you and get you out of your head and into your body. But yeah, as you said, you can't go from like exercising every day to like sitting in a hotel. It's great for like the first 2 days and you're like, oh, I'm going to catch up on all the TV series I've missed out on or ring friends, but you need to get blood flowing around your body because otherwise you'll get stuck in your head again. Well, that's me. Like everyone is completely different, but I can't sit still. So this has been an absolute test.
Yeah. And it's a weird one. I think particularly when you sling jet lag in there or anything else, the best laid plans of mice and men coming. I know when I was quarantining in Canada, I had plans to watch so much stuff. Everything I was putting on, I couldn't focus on. And I was like, I know this is a good show, so I don't want to just have it on and not, like if I'm not in the right frame of mind. So we were talking about your quarantine before it happened. And I was kind of saying, plan as much as you can, but be ready to not do any of it. Because again, it's what the mood takes at the time. But it's a weird one because what you've said there leads on perfectly. Because I was going to have you on for the mental health specials in May, but we decided we wanted to talk kind of in more depth rather than a little 10-minute chat because we'd been chatting back and forth about mental health off camera. And it's something I've spoken to a few friends about, but never really on a podcast. People like, I mean, I first really saw you in Virtues and then Calm with Horses. And these are heavy, dramatic shows. And I've spoken to our mutual friend, Stevie Graham, about this. We will praise and laud the performances when people go to these dark, dark places. I spoke a little bit with Vicky McClure about it as well. Some of the stuff that she got across in This Is England was heart-wrenching. But we don't talk much about what it takes to get to that place and then the impact after getting to that place. And I think where we were launched into unprecedented times with lockdowns and quarantines, there was maybe a bit of a learning curve there. Because I think you would normally have had, if you've done an emotional scene, you'll normally be able to then either go out for a drink with people in the evening to get yourself out of that headspace or catch up with someone in some way, have some kind of moment to remind you you're you rather than the character. But during at least the first chunk, all filming during that first chunk, you couldn't have any of that. So yeah, what were your experiences of that and how have you found it all?
Yeah, it's like you said, we've all gone through that experience of being kind of stuck in a place where we've kind of lost control of being able to, I suppose, busy ourselves. But yeah, that because I remember like I was texting you whenever I was shooting Deceit, and because my character is, I was in every day for 10 weeks straight, and it's heavy material, and the character goes quite on a psychological and mental journey and physically from beginning to end. And it was something that you had to be forgiving of yourself in the evenings and not break down every scene. Like, for me, it's like I'll never come away from a scene and go, I've nailed it. You know, when you, like, actor is, you've been on set when, like, you've heard people go, you smashed it, you nailed it. And you're like, I don't know what that means. Not that I'm not being, like, trying to be self-indulgent in it, but you, it's hard whenever, as you said, we get rewarded for going to an emotional place. And it's a weird feeling to get that reward, because in life, no one is seeing you break down and crying, going, well done. That moved me. If anything, they're doing the opposite. They kind of walk the other way and they go, she's having a little bit of a blubby moment over there. Just leave her be. But yeah, you can't say it's because you've convinced your body that, and your head to a certain extent, that the situation that you're in that scene is real. And you've created these chemicals in your body, and it's almost done that fight or flight reaction. And so what I found is that you go home at the end of the day and I couldn't sleep. And that was the problem. It was my sleep pattern went completely arseways. You know, there's three things you kind of need, and that your body is, and you as a person is kind of latching onto, and that is just sleep, food and shelter. And I suppose safety is those. And if one of those is being compromised or is out of whack, you can't really make proper decisions, and you can't really assess a situation clearly. Is that what, that's what I found. And so I think what I was beginning to do on a shoot, not just on Deceit, but on other shoots, was that because the characters were going through these kind of heartbreaking moments, that I was leaning into that and I was allowing my sleep pattern to purposely get disturbed, because then I could access that emotion really easily.
Yeah.
But it's not like, that's not normal. You can't maintain that. And it's just like a learning, it really is just a learning curve, because that isn't sustainable as a person to continuously be in that headspace. So it's like, you know, people talk about when they work on themselves, it's like, I've really in the last year really had to work on myself as an actor off screen in order to maintain this career. And I think being in a production like Raised by Wolves, where they're really empathetic and they know you're away from home, and they're reminding you of the importance of physical exercise, getting out, and also the importance that it is okay to, like, talk to someone outside of production if you are struggling, or just to talk to someone about anything.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's like, there is no weakness in that. And it's not, I think that is going to become more, I feel like, because we talked about the idea of, like, having an intimacy coordinator, but I think it's going to become more common practice to have, say, an emotional support coordinator.
Yeah.
On a set. Because it would take so much pressure off a director. Because, like, I just think about what goes through a director's head during a day when they have, like, so many scenes to get through. The last thing they want to do is check
in. Particularly in TV, where it's just a constant flow, right?
Yeah, well, you know, everyone's turning up as a professional and they're not kind of checking in with the, you know, the grip department and going, are you okay now with everything that went at the end of the scene? It's like, if you access an emotion for a character and you've done it and you've, I suppose, spoken truthfully in that scene and the director is happy, they're immediately thinking of the next scene that they need to capture, and they're not kind of going, oh, I need to check in with Niamh and make sure she's okay. But having someone, I think, on a set like that, we had this amazing woman called Kate Lush, and she'd just take us and we'd go into the green tent or cast holding and just get us to, like, meditate for 2-3 minutes, just doing kind of like Wim Hof breathing. And then you're reset, and then you can go and you're like, oh crap, yeah. And you just remind yourself it's acting. It's not, we don't need to torture ourselves. And I think that's so much easier said than done, but it's something that I found myself becoming more empathetic towards myself, to allow myself to kind of go, it's all right, you've just gone through this crazy adventure as a character, you can feel down, it's okay.
I often struggle to lose myself via Wim Hof breathing, purely because I went to Wim's house once and the first 30 minutes was him finding my name hilarious, just repeatedly, just ages of him going, Scroobius, screw it, just keep coming back to it. I was trying to bring the conversation on and move it. He found it hilarious. So I think I'd lose myself there. But it's interesting what you touched upon there, because I think there's a romanticism in the idea of the broken artist, of the damaged artist, of the tortured artist, of putting yourself through these things. And the actors that I talk to who don't have that issue or aren't tempted into that, to put themselves through that, are the ones who've got wives and kids.
Yeah.
Because they can't. They're like, I can't go home and be, I'm really in the character because you've got a kid who wants their breakfast and stuff like that. And I think that can be a positive thing because I think there is a tendency to lean in that direction. In all ways, you've also read the classic stories of directors who put their actors through absolute hell and they've made a classic. And you kind of go, well, still, that's not really acceptable, though, is it? Like it's wicked, but there's also absolute masterpieces that weren't born of discomfort and torture and horror. So I think it's a positive thing to try and push the art in better directions rather than going, you have to end this absolutely broken.
Yeah.
For the art.
It's so true. I remember on The Virtues, it was a scene, I think it was roughly around, it was the end of the series where Dina kills her mother. Spoiler alert, sorry. And in one of the takes, I kind of swiped all of the religious memorabilia that was around the house. And one of the pieces was actually nailed onto the, because it kept on wobbling in the scene. And it was like this cross and it kept on wobbling in the scene. And I swiped it. And I remember as I did, I just felt something like run down my hand. And it was blood. And I just continued on the scene and we kept going. And I remember being in the restaurant later on that night and Stevie Graham was there and he was just like, see that, what I'm trying to get at here is like, that wasn't necessary because at the end of the day, you're Niamh. It was fine in the scene.
Yeah.
But just remember, it's like, and it was an accident as well, but it's like, you see actors and they like punch walls and, in a scene and they end up like cracking a knuckle and it's not necessary.
But it's so tempting and alluring. It's so tempting, artist, isn't it?
Yeah, because you're like, I get to do this, and even though that was a mistake, I still have that like scar in my hand, and it's like, makes for a nice story. But if I look at that scar and I compare it to what my mental health would be, I'm kind of going like, it's not worth it. So it's just the art of letting go, isn't it? Just do the scene, let go, and then you can focus on the next scene for the day.
Yeah.
And it's easy. That's so much easier said than done, but there'll be practices in it,
Yeah. I mean, I want to also make it clear quickly, because we discussed this as well at the time. The production of Deceit was a wonderful one for keeping an eye on you, for looking after you and all this kind of thing. It wasn't like, I've just realised it sounds as if we're saying you were kind of left abandoned, but there were certain things in that period because of COVID and everything that, there's nothing that can be done.
We were so well looked after. Neil McCormack, the director on it, and Amelia, our writer, and Dave, our producer, they couldn't have gone, and another producer on it, like they couldn't have gone above and beyond to consult and check in.
Yeah.
It's just in the time that we made it, it was the first production back after the strict lockdown. And you know what it's like to be on a production. If you're staying in a hotel or like a cast or roughly in the same city, we'll all go and have a few pints after work and you can kind of unload like the day's shooting. But there wasn't that. We were just all going back to our houses or hotel rooms and just sitting there and going, oh God.
and unloading is the key term there. I know I talked about it at the time, but Samaritans do a thing where at the end of a shift, they unload. Every time there's a Samaritan shift, there has to be someone who's at home and is on for unloading. So at the end of the shift, you have to ring them and just say how the shift's gone and how you're feeling.
Yeah.
And that act of saying it out loud allows you to leave it there rather than take it back to your house or to your hotel or whatever else. And I think there's a lot of stuff that we do instinctively socially that is actually looking after our mental health. And that stuff changed during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have realised that you were, as I said, going for a drink after work. You wouldn't have realised that was part of your self-preservation.
Yeah.
But having it removed can really get it on top of you. And it's an interesting one because your character in Deceit, the role that you're playing is someone that's getting lost in playing a role. It's for people who don't know, it's coming out soon. It's on Channel 4. It's a true story of an undercover police officer. And watching it, I was like, there's such weird parallels to the job that we do. Like, there's a point where Sadie slash Lizzie is in hair and makeup and kind of having a light chat before going and doing something really heavy. And I was watching that thinking, that's the reality of this. That would have happened prior to this scene, kind of thing. It's such a weird parallel. So how was that to find that character and to, yeah, to relate, I guess?
Yeah. So before it, I consulted with several covert officers, female covert officers, who had gone undercover because Sadie Byrne, who, you know, is the character in this, is based upon the real life yeah. undercover officer that was involved, but it's not, I didn't have access to her. I couldn't contact her. So I had to create a character of my own based off my own research. And so I was speaking to this one undercover officer and she said, it was like, yeah, it's just exactly, it's like acting, maybe. It's like you're creating a character that you have to completely connect to, but also if you get it wrong, you could die.
Yeah.
And I was like, flipping hell. Like, you know, that's, you know, we're fine. And that's what's kind of like with acting. It's like, you know, if we get it wrong, no one's going to give out to you. They'll just have to go over and do more takes. But with them, it was, the pressure was so immense. They could completely commit and have your legend, which is, you know, this character that they create, to a T, that when they go into a situation with a drug dealer or like a paedophile, that they can't detect whether or not they're going to be, you know, uncovered. And as you said, it's like the same thing. It's like our job as an actor is to convince the audience that what we're saying is the truth.
Yeah.
We're just manipulating. I suppose there's a form of manipulation. So that word of manipulation was kind of like a way in for me as the character, is the idea that she is manipulating others, but also manipulating her own emotions. And there's a point where she exercises that skill so much that she can't switch it off.
Yeah.
And the lines between what she believes in and what this character believes in becomes incredibly blurred. And also, I think being in that headspace of not being able to go and have pints at the end of a day shoot and just going home was similar with this character, is that she would go on these dates and go back to her flat and then live with like what she's just said and talked about and how that would have been running around in her head all day. And it's incredible. Looking back on it now, it's just, I suppose it was fairly relatable as an actor, but also I think for her, like, she used to do this. She did it for like 18 months and you can understand how that would take such a massive toll. I think the longest I've ever played a character is 9. I don't know if that answered your question.
Completely. I was constantly finding the parallels interesting because the actual case happened in the early 90s, if I remember correctly. And again, there was real parallels in a male-dominated area, industry, mm-hmm. power-wise, and blurred lines over how far you're willing to go and what you're willing to do. And we've seen in the film and TV industry recently some horrible truths come through, allegations, I should say, but some terrible things revealed where people have been pushed further than they want to be pushed, or had it implied that if you don't do this, if you're not willing to be naked in this scene or audition or whatever else, then you won't get the role. And that felt like a parallel between, you know, what has gone on in film and TV and what was going on at that point and with this character. So again, I think it's a positive, as you said, intimacy officers and all these other different, or counsellors and whatnot. It's moving in a positive direction, right? I think we're moving away from if you're an artist, you'll do this or you won't worry about it. Because again, it's completely human. As you said with Stevie, after you've cut your hand, saying you're still Neve. It's not that you've now got to take that on with you, the physical and the mental. So
yeah. But as you said about that whole importance of offloading with officers, like undercover officers, especially during the late 80s and early 90s, which was the time we'd set this character, is that they didn't have emotional support.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have counsellors that they could go and talk to and say how the job was affecting them. Whereas now it's compulsory.
Yeah.
They have to go to like weekly weekly counselling sessions, or if, you know, it depends on if they're within an operation, they have to do that then and there, and they offload before the end of the day, as you said. So they're not bringing that home.
Yeah. Mm. Again, I love the positive changes. On the one I was shooting in Canada, when while you were shooting a deceit, I had someone reach out because I had my first a topless scene, and I didn't expect it. I had someone reach out and just go, just want to make sure you're comfortable with everything. Have you got any concerns? And I was like, I am. It would have been dope if I knew a few more weeks ahead of time, because I've been in isolation and quarantine on my own, so I may not be at my best, but is what it is. But things like that really struck me as how all these things should be done, because that isn't even a sex scene or a nude scene or a far more uncomfortable scene, yet someone was reaching out to make sure to go, everything okay? Is there anything that we can do? Is there anything that you need? And yeah, that's positive to see and to hear, I guess.
Yeah, that is great to hear.
So it's interesting, because again, where we planned to talk about the impact of things on your mental health, I was watching The Seat and thinking it parallels amazingly, because it is that a lot of that is about the mental health of Sadie and the struggles that she has. But then also Censor, it's kind of about someone being impacted by all of the stuff that they do at work and taking it home with them. So a Censor is about the people who give the age classifications and censorship for films in the era of the video nasties. And your character in that, you know, has to watch a load of grim and gruesome stuff and choose what is safe for people to see, kind of by seeing it herself, which is a weird one. So how was that as a project to kind of go, right, this is interesting? Because again, it's weird, man, because Censor couldn't be more different from Deceit, yet they're all actually about mental health in one way or another, and how things get to us, and how we as humans these days assume that we can just cope with everything, when in reality there's limits to what we can realistically handle in our own head. So yeah, how was that to get into that role and shoot?
That was a fascinating character to, and with Prano Bailey Bond, the director, she's wicked, she's amazing. Because what was so interesting about that is it's psychological distortion. The character has witnessed something as a child that's created this deep-rooted PTSD and childhood trauma of losing her sister. And so how that can be seeded as a child and how it can manifest into being an adult, and how you suppress those feelings and memories. And I suppose when I had read the script is that I'd never experienced or seen a character, especially a female character, that goes on this journey and deals with suppressed memories and psychological distortion. And so how you could, as an artist or actor, take that and present something an audience hasn't seen before in the most truthful way. I'm not just, you know, just kind of going like, she just goes mad.
Or that's the beauty of it, because it comes to the viewer as quite a sharp incline. But as you said, with things like PTSD from childhood, it's going to be stuff that's there. There's going to be micro cues and triggers and identifiers that we wouldn't notice because they've become so normal in the life. So that when that one specific thing comes along, it seems like you've gone from normal to intense in moments. But in reality, it was all there. It's just that one thing that makes you swerve off the road as such.
It's the one kind of event, or there's kind of several events kind of throughout the whole script that cause her to kind of go off kilter, and then the one thing of seeing that film of Don't Go in the Church that has this quite a pivotal effect on her. And myself and Prano had sat down months beforehand. I was in Cape Town on season one shooting Raised by Wolves when this project came in, so we had spent weekends just figuring out the kind of emotional arc of the character, and then also the physical arc. So she goes from this very upright, rigid and held together human to someone who's almost collapsed in on themselves and is unwinding from the seams. And so, you know yourself, you shoot something completely out of sequence based off of location. So it was seeding in and creating, just picking the moments of where the characters, those bits are going to be showcased. So you're not just, I suppose, repeating beats. Because that can easily happen. Is that, not that it can easily happen, but you can, like on your first week, you could end up shooting the end of the movie and then you're going to have to work your way back from that and create an arc that is believable and smooth. But also, I suppose, letting everything happen naturally and organically. But it was another it was another character who's exploring the depths of their emotions in certain extents. But she's a completely different character to Sadie. I think I need to do a comedy as well.
Yeah, you maybe need to lighten it up. But
I need to lighten it up a bit.
It's an interesting one. This is going to sound like a weird tangent, but you know my brain works on weird angles. But Conor McGregor at the weekend, his ankle snapped in his fight with Dustin Poirier. And a lot of people were talking about Muay Thai training. And I know you like to beat a bag and some pads up every now and then. So in Muay Thai training, there's a split in the science behind the strengthening of their shins. And some argue that they essentially do small fractures and let them heal, and it strengthens overall. But some argue that those small fractures can make it so it's kind of almost perforated, so all of a sudden it can just tear. And Connor's one at the weekend, it snapped in half from a seemingly small kick. And that made me think of, like, your character in Sensor, for example, where it can be these micro things that have done small damages. You could go through the rest of your life not realizing there's any kind of mental health major issue here. Mm. But it could be that it finds that one thing, like watching the film that she saw, that snaps all of it. All the small perforations all go at once rather than strengthening. And yeah, I think it's a fascinating thing to watch unfold in that film. It hadn't even crossed my mind. I try not to get too inside the actor's studio when watching things, because it does my head in to think about, man, you didn't shoot that in order. That's a head fuck. That's too much to get your head round, because again, it's so weird to get all that. But yeah, it must have been really interesting to find all those small moments and big moments to make it feel believable, particularly in a genre piece. It is a crazy horror, and it's not The Virtues or Calm with Horses or these kinds of things. It is bigger and crazier visually and sonically. So finding where you need the subtleties and where you need to explode must have been a fascinating journey back and forth with Prano, I'd imagine.
Yeah, well, she's literally in the scenes with you. She has her little kind of portable director's monitor, and she's right there. Like, for when we shot the sequence in which she watches Don't Go in the Church, and she sees, feels like she sees her sister for the first time in 20 years. She was just like off screen, just talking through it, because, brilliant, you know, we're not watching, we're looking at flickering lights and everything that we're imagining as the actor has to narratively play out in our heads, as opposed to having the luxury of seeing the thing that she's actually looking at. Because there's a camera in front of you, so it can't be there. But I think it all has to come from trust. You know, you have to, sometimes you can't see, the actor can't see the bigger picture of what the director is creating.
Yeah.
We can just trust that what we did in the scene, we believed as me, as Niamh. Yeah. But if they say, right, we need to pull it back in that emotion, or you need to go bigger there in the laugh, or can you make that, quicken the timing on this? You have to completely trust that that's the right choice, and just give, I think you just need to give over some of your creative and artistic rights to your director, because ultimately it's their vision and they're going to do with it with what they want. And when you do that, it just frees everything up. And it's funny, like, how for like a genre film, or you're not playing it for scares. I think the minute you start to play something for scares, it's not going to be funny, or it's not going to be funny, not being scary. But
I think it works across the board. Like, funny is a prime example there. The funny things I've done that I've got the most praise for, I played 100% straight.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a comedian. I'm, and again, I think you're completely right on all of these things. You play it as a human, and then it's funny because of the screen, because you're watching it through a screen rather than being there or being the individual. Mm. And same with scary or horror, rather than going, ooh, and jumping out and being spooky.
Yeah. Well, I suppose so much of horror is that there's so much other stuff going on to create that atmosphere, especially with music and sound.
Yeah.
And the way in which you reveal a scene. But it's, I suppose with Enid, it was, as you said, it's she goes on such a massive shift from where she begins and where she ends. But as you said, it's like if you let everything bottle up for so long, eventually it's going to explode.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And again, you're completely right there. There's an amazing book by Bresson where he talks about the overlooked importance of editors in film and TV, and how you can, what is before and after a scene or a shot even, can completely change the mood and the tone. That's why you have to submit on set to the bigger picture, rather than think, no, well, it's not scary at this point, or it's not dramatic enough. It's like, well, you just stood there with your head down. If it's come before this and that, that's enough. But I guess, how did you find putting that faith in someone when, again, Prano, a new talent, her debut feature? How was that to kind of find that faith and trust and go, right, I believe in this person? And then it pay off. Yeah, it wasn't that, oh, I made a mistake there.
I met her at the Screen International Stars of Tomorrow. Such a long title. And we just had a very instant connection. And you can just tell when someone is the ambition and, I suppose, what's the word? Not drive. It's more just like, I think trust you put in others when you can see that the vision that they're going to create is kind of like you're on the same board. I'm not really making any sense. It's like that feeling. It's like that gut feeling,
yeah,
of almost like when you find the person that you're going to spend the rest of your life with.
Yeah.
It's like a gut feeling of being on the same page. But also with Prano, it never felt like this was her debut feature film.
Yeah.
I felt like she was a woman this is like her 10th feature, and she's about to go direct a TV series at the same time while writing a book or something.
Yeah.
She's
yeah,
so talented. So it didn't take long for me to like kind of go, all right, you can do whatever you want and tell me to go deep into that well or run across that forest and with an axe in my hand.
It's got to be when you can tell how much it means to them. I think it's why it's often easier to find that trust on set, on film, than it can be sometimes with long series TV. I remember the second acting gig I ever did, a guy I was in a scene with really kind of had it out with one of the directors, and I'm sitting there like, man, everyone just chill, like just trust the director and do as you're told. And it wasn't until me and that actor went aside, because we took a break because it all got so tense, that he kind of said, look, this is episode 8. I've known this character for 8 episodes. The director is only on for 1 episode. I feel I need to make sure I'm doing what is right for the character rather than someone who's just in for... Because it is a weird thing with, particularly with American TV, a different director every episode, you know, all these different things. Mm. So that was kind of an interesting thing to see, where at first I had that completely, just trust the dude. He knows what's going on. You're in your own head. But then I could see his side of it as well, when he kind of said, no, I know the character. I've been playing this character for 5 months at this stage. He wouldn't have made that choice or done that thing. And I think if you're making a film, it's more you're a collaborator from beginning to end.
Yeah.
You know?
I do find that when I go to episodic telly, it's always going to be about the story, and you have to make the story work.
Yeah.
You know, the characters are all there and people invest in the characters, but ultimately it's the story that people are buying into. And it's so true. Yeah. But like, and it's mad because like on Raised by Wolves, I remember Ridley saying, it's like, your character is your island, so you need to protect it. And you are almost like the lawyer to that character. You're the only one who is going to have the hours to put in and research and figure out and justify the actions that they choose and within the story. 100%. No one else has that time. So if, for example, you are going into a scene, you as a lawyer, it's like you're turning up for court to defend your client, and you're going like, oh, okay, you want me to come through the door? I thought I was already sitting in the scene. And then you have to go back and figure out, okay, well, why are they coming through the door and not sitting in the scene? And that's your job. But you can't be like, protest and go, no, I'm already sitting down in the scene.
Yeah.
It's collaboration. At the end of the day, filmmaking is, it's collaboration.
It's the beauty of it, isn't it?
Bringing it back to like Prana was that I immediately felt that trust is because how she talks to everyone on the crew and how she talks to the cast is the complete same.
Yeah.
And she listens to everyone and hears what it is that they need out of her and what they need and what they require for that to make that scene work. And when everyone feels heard, everyone is on board with creating this one thing. Yeah. And listening to the one person that's vision it is, and it's ultimately hers. So yeah, I think that brings us back to
it does
to trust.
No, it's perfect. But I want to pause you for a second and just put a bit of amazing reality on top of you as you're sat in your quarantine hotel 3 days in on Zoom. We're just chatting away. You got to start a sentence by saying, I remember Ridley saying, and that's Ridley Scott, like literal, actual icon. How crazy is that? That you've done two series now with Ridley, and it's this huge, amazing, again, couldn't be more different from the low-key, I guess, intimacy of things like Virtues. It's big. I mean, the costumes are cool as fuck. The haircuts are cool. Everything about it just gets you, allows you to go out there and be, man, how cool is this kind of thing? So how's that been? And working with Ridley, again, you've been doing it, you've done two seasons of long shoots, so yeah, it will become a day-to-day life. But how often do you get to kind of pull yourself back and go, man, how crazy is this?
Oh, like every day I was doing that. It wasn't like, that's because, you know, where we were in Cape Town, in the studio, like we occupied the entire Cape Town Film Studios, which is like five studios.
Wow.
And had all the sets there. And then we had our external locations. But, you know, he's not that he's like a big kid, but he has the energy of a kid. Like his energy is infectious.
Yeah.
And it's that passion. You know, when you see someone who is still so passionate about the filmmaking and the stories that he's making, as he probably had when he's, you know, first started out, you know, he's definitely one to watch.
yeah, keep an eye on him.
Keep an eye on him.
I love hearing about these icons and the way they make, the way they shoot. It's something we touched upon earlier, an example of Quentin Tarantino. He shoots in script order.
Mm.
And I worked with some guys, the Blaine brothers, recently, who do the same, because they were told originally, yeah, but Quentin shoots in script order, or Quentin can shoot in script order because he's Quentin Tarantino. And their argument was, yeah, but maybe he's Quentin Tarantino because he shoots in script. Like, maybe it's flipped the other way around. And Ridley's a similar one. You hear of the amazing just multi-camera for every scene, so he can capture everything. And people will argue, for newer directors or upcoming, to go, yeah, but that's Ridley Scott. Of course he can do that. But I would argue, well, maybe that's why he's Ridley Scott. Maybe we shouldn't go, oh, these things are unachievable. Us mere mortals couldn't film like that. When it's like, well, maybe that's, there's a reason for it. And obviously there's a reason for it. But how much freedom does working in that way give you with multiple cameras, so you know each go through of a scene, you're being picked up on close up, on mid, on multiple things. How is that to work?
It's great. And Shane Meadows does the same thing as well. Yeah. But he shoots chronologically. Well, like with Ridley, I was in season one, I was meant to fly out kind of mid January. And then they rang me just after Christmas and was like, by the way, we're going to have to come bring you out 2 weeks in advance. And I was like, okay. He's like, yeah, Ridley's 2 weeks ahead of schedule in filming. You know, it's like,
that's what? The opposite of every like, job you like, ever do, ever.
Like 2 weeks ahead of schedule is like mental.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was, like, I'm not going to lie, like, I was terrified in season one. Like, I was terrified. You're like, oh, I'm going to get found out. He's probably going to look at the casting sheet and go, wait a minute, what? That wasn't the girl who I cast. You know, and you're always like, I've never had such insane imposter syndrome when I was out there for the first season, you know, because Ridley is like my hero. Alien was it the reason why I fell in love with horror. But like when you shoot a multi-camera, it means that I suppose they have more choices, I suppose, in those takes, because you're not, you can change it up, I suppose, is the reason after mm-hmm. after a few takes, because you've established it on the close, wide and mid. But he come in and he doesn't over explain scenes, and that's, I think, so important. Like, I've worked with directors in the past where there'd be just too much information being thrown at you, and you've kind of forgotten the first note because they've given you seven notes. And I always find that the best director is the one that just kind of give you one clear note, and so you can just kind of focus on that, and it kind of frees you up. And he would do that. He would just be like, "Yeah, you're a soldier, you're a combat medic, and you need supplies. So everything you see on this set right now is free for you to kind of touch and move and take with you." And so you then begin to forget about the dialogue and you connect with your surroundings. And I think sometimes you forget that as an actor. It's like, you can touch these props as opposed to just making sure that what you're saying is the most important thing in the scene. It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that must be partly as well the freedom of the multi kind of cam shooting, because there's, in the traditional form, there is a thought of anything you touch, you've then got to touch in the same way on the next four set up. So I casually, I remember a film I did in France where I casually just, I put my arms up on the back of the sofa. That day in my hotel room, I've never been in as much pain because I had to be up like that for every scene. And actually, it's not as relaxing as it looks. It's really uncomfortable. And I had the biggest regret over making a choice in an early version, in the wide or whatever. It's like, right, now every scene, I'm doing
this.
That's
so true. I was squatting in a scene there. Last month, I do this scene where I'd come in and kind of squat and kind of hold the squat.
Yeah.
And I was like, by take two, I was like, I have made a massive mistake.
This is an error.
My legs were like burning the next morning. I felt like I'd just run up a hill. Yeah.
It's
props are the worst. I remember when I worked with an actor one time, it was like, anytime you get given a prop, try and put it down.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it becomes all about the prop and you can't remember, or food eaten in a scene. Oh, man. Yeah. Or cigarette smoke. Oh, with the character of Sadie smokes in deceit. And I puked one day on set because I'd smoked so much in a take. And I didn't need to. I just, you start to panic because I'm not a smoker. Yeah. So you start panicking. You start to like overuse the cigarette.
Here I am holding it.
I have to burn in myself as well.
Yeah.
God, cigarettes are the worst.
You see, I quite like a prop for the exact thing that you were saying there, of making myself forget about the dialogue. Because I think, weirdly, because I've actually got a stutter and most of my characters don't have a stutter, I can overthink the dialogue at points, because I will have planned out the night before where I'm going to breathe, where I'm, and all different things, because it's how I can manage to not stutter in a scene. So I will have put in all this extra work. But it's exactly the same as anyone else. Once you've put the work in, you can stop thinking about it, if you know what I mean. But it's not as easy. So I quite like, again, on Debris I was doing in Canada, there was one of the last things we shot. I had a load of different props I had to get. I had to go and set up these scanners and then get these pills and give them to each person. And it was my favourite scene, because I was like, my character would be really focused on that rather than what he's saying. Because in day-to-day life, we're not sitting there thinking, oh, what shall I say next? We're doing the stuff that we need to do and speech is just coming out. And I adored that, because I was like, right, I know I've got to do that and then that and then that and then that. And it just meant all the dialogue was just, it's an afterthought, which is nature. It's not about, oh, how am I going to deliver this dramatic speech? Like, you don't think that in real life. So, yeah.
You become like unaware of what you look like.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it. It's like kids, which they don't realise what they're...
I mean, I do want to go back briefly before we wrap up, as we get into that area. How was it to work on a sci-fi like this? Because again, it just looks so beautiful. And as said, I watched every episode of Series 1 and thought everyone filming that must have felt so cool when they were filming it. Just because, again, it all looks amazingly, all the character design and everything, from your guys to the kind of the people that you're against as such, and the mother and father and all this. How did that feel each day, just getting to go and play dress up as such?
Yeah, it was. We were like big kids, to be honest.
Yeah.
The costumes and...
It felt like it would be. It felt as not to demean the art of any of it. It felt like I would be sitting there each morning thinking, fucking cool, I get to go and be that person now, rather than, well, this is going to be a heavy day. this is going to be depressing. I get to go and be a space person. Sweet.
Space girl.
Yeah.
And we're working with a lot of kids as well on that show, that you do get reminded that this is like a big game.
Yeah, you're playing. And
we're playing. But I think it's quite important, especially with the sci-fi, not to take it as seriously, but to obviously you ground it in the most kind of relatable thing as you can as a human that's gone through something similar, because every now and again, your brain will go, what did I just say? Like, what does that mean? there's flying snakes and if you begin to think about it too much, it can kind of overwhelm you, because you're like, I don't know, I've never experienced a flying snake, but you know, I'm scared of real snakes. So just connected to that. And yeah, no, like, it's amazing. It was a long shoot and the heat was like crazy, as in it was cool, but we were like 100 degrees. And then Abu and Amanda are in their latex suits. So every time we complained about the heat, we kind of have to look over and they're kind of giving you like a cocked look of going, seriously, like,
you'll be fine.
You'll be fine. We're in latex, for God's sake. And every time we have to go to the toilet, it takes us like an hour and someone has to unzip us and cover us in talcum powder. So yeah, so much, just a lot of fun. And we created a proper family of cast out there and crew. And yeah, you kind of make lifetime friends, you know.
Is this the first show you've done that's multi seasons and you get that kind of family feel about it? It's a weird nomadic job at times, that you'll do a film or a TV show and you'll become so close to these people for that period of time, and then you're on to the next gig. So was it nice to return to them and be like, oh, here we are.
Yeah.
I remember you guys.
Because there's a familiarity to it, you know, and that you, for as in season one, you feel like everyone had that sense of imposter syndrome on this big show. And then season two, it's like we had a lot of the same crew returning. So just to feel like you had those familiar faces that were, you know, half covered with a mask with new COVID protocols is nice, because you're so far away from home, and we couldn't leave at all. You know, we couldn't travel to and from. So knowing that you were going back to that familiarity is so nice.
Yeah. So to wrap things up, what's ahead and what's the plan? You know, after you've got six more sleeps in quarantine, have you got stuff immediately lined up? Are you excited to just be back for a bit? Because I said it's a fucking weird time to be working, and you've been really lucky to have some great projects, but it is isolating, and it does take you. It's not the time where, as you say, you could have been, you've got a week off, I'll pop home, or someone will come out and visit, or vice versa. It's all very restricted. So yeah, what's the plan? What are you looking forward to, and what's ahead?
I'm looking forward to getting out of the hotel, seeing the big bad world. And I'll take a couple of weeks, and then I'm starting another project in Ireland that I'm not allowed to talk about. But
are you excited to get back to Ireland though? Because again,
I haven't seen my family since before Christmas.
Yeah,
yeah. So that's the longest I think I've been away. I'm just really looking forward to shooting back in Ireland. Like, I shot Cam with Horses there, and that's about 3 years ago, I think, now at this stage. And so just looking forward to just seeing friends. I'm sick of FaceTime. I'm so sick of it. I'm done with it.
Yeah.
You know, no one sits and looks at their phone for an hour solid staring at someone. If we did that, we'd all get freaked out.
Yeah.
We'd be like, what is wrong with you? Why have you not looked away?
It's a bizarre normality, isn't it, that we've all kind of taken to accept.
Yeah, I've gotten into The Sopranos. I started The Sopranos this season. Or great. this week.
Great.
I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's an Italian family.
I've heard of them. It was my quarantine thing. I took the entire Blu-ray set to Canada with me, and over the 6 months I was out there, I watched the whole lot. But it's amazing.
Did you feel like you were a part of the family?
Oh, completely.
I feel like I'm in it now. I feel like I'm part of the family, and I do anything for Tony. You know?
100%.
What do you need me to do, Tony? Let's do.
Yeah.
Oh, have you seen the trailer for The Many Saints of Newark?
It looks amazing, doesn't it? His Gandolfini's son in that just looks like he's got it absolutely nailed.
that incredible screen presence.
Yeah.
Doesn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Completely. It's exciting. Well, it's been lovely staring at a screen for an hour. I'm excited for all that is ahead. When this goes out, I think Sensor will maybe have just come out and Deceit will be on its way.
Or is it the other way around? It could be the other way around.
Could be the other way around.
Yeah.
Hard to say. And I guess Raised by Wolves is probably a fair way off because sci-fi, it takes ages to put together and make it look pretty. But yeah, excited to catch it all and for all that is ahead.
Absolutely, Pep. It was lovely chatting to you. I love this podcast. This is I go for a run and I listen to this.
I love it.
Yeah. When we were in Cape Town, we went on a safari, and as we were driving back, we listened to the mental health series in the car. So we were in like this minibus and we put it on, and all the cast was just listening to it as we drove back to Cape Town. And there was a few tears, many laughs, but like it was just so refreshing to listen to people who were so honest.
Yeah.
You know,
I love important. That. And it's completely surreal to me, the thought of that. You guys out there shooting this amazing thing and then a little minibus full of people who I've watched on screen and loved all going back listening to me and my mum rambling, or me and my goddaughter, or me and Stevie, all these people. I love it. Well, as said, it's been a pleasure, and we'll catch up soon.
We shall. All right, Pep. Thanks, love.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Neve, back by Dope Demand. If this is the first time you've heard Neve, go and check out our previous chat, because it's really good. And yeah, it'll tie things up nicely between the two. I'll be back next week, as I mentioned, with Nathaniel Martello. Why? Actually, I never pre-hype episodes, right? I normally keep it a bit quiet as to what's to come, but as I've recorded this intro and outro, today I recorded an episode with a much requested guest, Loki, and it is astounding. That dude, his mind is amazing. So it's not going to be out for a few weeks, but I thought I'd treat you to a little pre-hype there. But tune in next week, because my chat with Nathaniel Martello White is also astounding. It's one of them ones. It was similar to the recent one with Sean Levy, where it felt that we just clicked on our approach to things artistically. And yeah, it was a joy to have that conversation. I'm so excited for what is ahead from that gentleman as well. But you'll hear about that next week. For now, stay safe, stay sane, go and see Sensor in the cinema, and watch Deceit on all four. All right, ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.